Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Joining me today on the Stone Chapel is Michael Thompson. He is the Acquisition and Development Editor at Whippenstock Publishers. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. I look forward to the conversation.
Now, this is your first time at the Lanier Library, the Stone Chapel, and now we're in the cottage where scholars can stay when they come and visit on sabbaticals. So what's your impression?
Oh, I'm quite taken with the place. I'm considering moving in on a full-time basis if they'll let me, or I might have to sneak into some corner. It's beautiful. The library is massive, impressive, and just beautiful. The aesthetics of the place are quite stunning. And this cottage is very, very charming is the right word.
Yeah, I think so. Anything the Laniers do is done for our first class, I think. Mm. Well, we hope you'll come back for lectures and other things as well.
I'm motivated now.
If you just need a place to come, and we've had other publishers come down and stay for us and with us, that kind of thing.
So, well, I'll keep that in mind. Yes.
So how did you get into academic publishing? Did you wake up one day as a 9-year-old and say, I want to be an academic publisher? What was that journey like?
No, as a 9-year-old, I wanted to be a veterinarian because I love my dog. The move towards academic publishing was partly accidental and partly organic. I worked since my BA years in bookstores, first in Montreal, the CLC bookstore, the Christian Literature Crusade bookstore, while I was doing my studies, and that helped raise some of the funds for my school and all that. When I went to Regent College for my master's, I walked right into the bookstore on my first day and said to Bill Reimer, the manager there, I would love to work. I have experience. And he actually apparently, I did it just at the right time. So all through Regent College, my master's studies, I also worked in the bookstore. And it was there that I met Sam Erdmans, who was coming through from the Erdmans Publishing Company. And we struck up a conversation that went pretty well. And I wasn't shopping for work. I was in the MDiv program at the time, thinking I would go into pastoral work. And somehow we wound up, I remember at one point having lunch together on this visit, and I probably dropped the what if I wanted to be in publishing kind of question. I was an assistant manager at the Regent Bookstore, and I would call him to try to do commentary sales and squeeze some extra discount out of the man and that sort of thing. And he liked my gumption, I guess. Yeah. And when his brother moved out of the company, he actually called me and said, would you consider applying for a job at Erdmans?
And what was that job?
It was in sales at the beginning. I started working with special accounts. I worked in various things. And while doing sales, I showed a knack, almost by accident, I suppose, to strike up conversations when I was on a given campus with scholars that I would see. And I started bringing manuscripts in, just sort of on the side, and I would hand them over.
So that wasn't really your job, but you started being in acquisitions before you were in acquisitions.
Exactly. And to my great surprise, to some degree, they actually encouraged it, mostly. And at first, they were a little surprised that this was happening, but I was doing it kind of on the side, between things. But I started to land some pretty good people, like John Collins and Joseph Fitzmyer, and while I was in sales. And at one point, Jan Pott, when someone else who was doing acquisitions was stepping out of that role, suggested that I should shift over, that I would move out of sales and full-time into acquisitions. And that's been quite a while now. But Jan really was the one. Jan Pott mentored me into the role that I currently had at Erdmans, and then took up again with Cascade Whippenstock. So that's the nutshell.
Yeah. And how long have you been with Cascade Whippenstock?
almost a year and a half now.
Yeah.
That's coming up to it. Yeah.
Well, we have 100,000 volumes in our library, and I bet your signature in some way is on a lot of these books that you acquired for Erdmann's and that you are now acquiring for Wittgenstock.
Yeah, if you go through a few of the Erdmann's volumes, you'll once in a while find someone thanking their acquisitions editor along the way, which is always very flattering. But
Your job is really behind the scenes, though, right?
Behind the scenes, yeah. I work up to the point where someone will take up the copy editing. So the acquiring and the developing of the idea and making sure that it's honed correctly and that what comes in is what we're expecting, and then someone picks it up from there usually. I do some editing, but mostly I do the pre-editing, if you will.
The pre-editing part. So what is the sort of mission, unique niche that Wittgenstock and Cascade is filling right now?
Right. As with some of the other presses out there, we have several imprints, and each have a slightly different mission. But for the purposes of my career, 90% of the work I pour into the company will build up the Cascade Wittgenstock imprint. And Cascade is an imprint that was created about 20 years ago. And bit by bit, they've been pulling in really some of the top editors in the industry. Casey Hansen from Fortress, who was really the DNA of their backbone, maybe is the better way to put it, of their Bible program for many years. Robin Perry from the UK, who is really the heart and soul of Paternoster, and Paternoster was really a great press, and so on. And me most recently, and others, of course, as well. So the idea was to build an ecumenically diverse and rich academic press, and I would say the range of that mission would include learned books for pastors all the way to academic books that are really for different communities of scholars. So the range would be within that umbrella, if you will. Maybe when I say pastors, I think I'm thinking in terms of level of readership, pastors, possibly also some, not just possibly, definitely some for students as well, classrooms, and so on. Much like Erdmann's or much like Baker Academic has that sort of range. The one advantage we had coming into this is they were able to jump in with the idea of being ecumenical. So Jewish scholarship, Anglican scholars, Lutheran scholars, Pentecostal scholars, they're all represented. Whereas both Erdmann's and Baker, which are terrific, had to move, or let me put it a different way, had to start folding in other traditions. They started with more evangelical and reformed.
Right.
And they're doing a great job at it, don't get me wrong. But we were able to say, this is what we want to do from go. We didn't have a heritage that we had to then manipulate and work around, which has allowed us to be very nimble, which is nice. No one's surprised that we do anything, and never have been, I think, because of that. The second imprint, Pickwick, is more technical, the other academic imprint we do. So books that may come out of conferences, books that may be dissertations would go there. Some of the more technical series would be published on Pickwick as well. And lastly, the Wittgenstock imprint, it's very general space. So it has, sometimes it's people who haven't finished their PhD, but they write a smart book, or sometimes it's a scholar who may be working in a non-accredited school, but they've written a good book, and sometimes it's a writing pastor who will write and be published there.
Yeah.
So the range there is a little more mixed. So that's the three imprints that are predominantly under my what I work with.
Talk a little bit about the kind of the connection. One of the things I say about the Lydier Library and the Stone Chapel is that we want to help the church appreciate the academy, but also the academy to appreciate the church as well.
That's great.
And a part of that really is about publishing, because a lot of the stuff that people read in the church has to go through a publisher like Wittgenstock, Cascade, or maybe more technically Pickwick. But it starts in the academy. So is it symbiosis? What's the kind of relationship that goes on between the three?
Between church, academy, and publishing. Right.
Because to some degree, a book can make a scholar.
Sure, absolutely, right. or sort of set their career on a certain path.
Exactly.
Right. It's interesting because I think when it comes to the church, there are very different things happening in publishing. Some of the publishing that's done for lay people these days seems to bypass academy tradition formation in any of the traditional senses. There's a good amount of popular publishing, which is a little more than a little thin in terms of the theological backbone, if you will.
Right.
We don't publish in that space. There are a number of publishers that do. And I know many pastors that I've spoken to, not all, but many, that find that frustrating, that they find it hard, because this tends to be driven by media more. People involved with religious media, be it radio, TV, or some other thing.
Or podcasts, maybe.
Or possibly podcasts. But a lot of it is driven by this a different set of concerns that are financially driven. Whereas when it comes to theological publishing, yeah, I think there's a symbiosis. Scholars will cut their teeth on a book or two in publishing. They'll get promoted, get discovered, get read, get assigned sometimes in classrooms or discovered by reading pastors. They, in turn, are formed within those traditions. They will be tending to buy books that sort of build on that heritage, that foundation. Right. And books, you know, by all these kinds of publishing houses, be they Cascade or IVP or Zondervan or any of these. But it's not universal. It's not, there's definitely some discontinuity between what's read in churches and what theological publishers are doing. And one of the things that's made it harder for that to be as organic as it used to be is the near elimination of the bookstore and the marketing of certain kinds of bookstores to churches and pastors. I'm thinking of Cokesbury. I'm thinking of even Lifeway. Used to do a lot more in that space. I think they still do some. Family's now gone, if you will.
Right.
But Cokesbury for mainline churches was certainly a huge, huge hub of being able to have good, thoughtful books. Years ago,
the loss of the sort of family Christian bookstore,
the family Christian bookstore
down in the strip mall,
right. But the ones especially
affected things,
absolutely, especially the ones though that took the vocation as booksellers very seriously. Mm. But it's gone even
as
deeper than that, as a calling.
As a calling.
How many good seminary bookstores remain compared to when we were slightly younger men?
Yes, yeah. Without so much gray in the beard, right? The gray beards.
I mean, you could have gone to Boston and found a great seminary bookstore. You could have gone to L.A. You can still find one. Well, no, you can't anymore because the Archives bookstore is closed now. Mm. And so on. But you know, Chicago, you name the city, what's the biggest, best bookstore in this space?
Right.
There are fewer of them. Regent Bookstore in Vancouver, my old school, one of the few that still hangs on by a thread, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting, the changes that have taken place.
Yeah, massive
changes.
Some would
say, you know, yeah, these are great changes because now I can shop for books sitting in my living room, right, without having to think beyond it. So a lot of people out there maybe listening would be interested in publishing a book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What's the process? What's the process first? And then kind of the second question is, what do you look for?
Right. I mean, anyone can submit a book, and every book will receive some consideration.
A proposal, right?
Sometimes it's just cold. They'll write someone, or they'll go to our, we have a submissions generic email on our website, and that's certainly a possible way in. Better is to, cultivate relationships into a press through careful work that leads you, let's say, to either another author who's published or a professor who's published or a pastor who's published, because the relational connectivity will strengthen, you know, how seriously a proposal
so relationships matter.
They do, because trust is, so if you by day are a doctor or a bus driver and you want to submit your reflections on the Gospel of John, that's perfectly fine thing to do. But for a publisher to decide to invest in a specific project, the relational trust is the sort of thing where someone says, this scholar who knows what he's talking about is saying, yeah, this person, at least for a certain level, is writing something here that is useful. So in terms of sort of that generic way, most people, though, that we publish in our academic program are coming up through the ranks at some level as people being formed by Christian Academy, be it seminary or university. And the first thing they'll usually seek to publish is their dissertation, which is not unusual. Or projects that grow out of it.
So there's Pickwick for that.
Pickwick for the most dissertations for us would be on Pickwick, because most dissertations tend to be written in a very technical style that essentially demonstrates to a very small cabal that you know what you're talking about.
Usually a doctoral committee.
Right.
Kind of thing.
So when you write for three people, it's hard to make that project leap beyond. But very often it will lead to things that you will write or research that would be useful.
So if somebody goes to whipvenstock.com, W-I-P-F, whipvenstock, and there's a book proposal sort of schematic there, an outline of what they need, kind of thing?
Yes.
And then they submit that, and it goes to you and your committee, and as an acquisitions editor, you've got to make a decision. But you're not making a decision on your own, are you?
No, everything goes to committee, as you suggested. There are proposals that get weeded out and don't make it to committee. I'll give you I haven't seen this at Whippenstock because I haven't seen what those are called, at Erdman's used to call it the slush pile. And that sounds a little rude, but it meant you just never knew what was going to be in there. And quite literally, I'd seen proposals about ministering to people who were abducted by aliens kind of proposals.
Oh, interesting.
And that was a real proposal.
Wow.
To you know, sometimes real gems. Someone who actually has some decent formation. Maybe they did a D-min and they're a pastor. And there's a real wisely well-shaped idea. So maybe this is their first attempt to move into that. But at least it deserves time of day. And so when I say not everything makes it, it's that sort of separation of wheat from the chaff, and that happens sometimes even before it comes to committee. I can't find my specific page, but somewhere on our website there is a process, a tab that will lead you to submitting a book.
And there's some work to submit a book proposal. It's not just something you can do on a Friday afternoon or something. It takes a little while to think through it and to come up with those answers. So it goes to you, the committee accepts it, and then what happens?
So assuming the committee accepts it, you'd be in touch with an editor if you weren't already. Often you are by the time you submit a proposal, but if you haven't been, then an editor will be following up with you. And depending on what sort of book it is and which imprint we think it belongs on, you know, it'll be one person or another person, basically. Someone will follow up with you, because the processes of producing something that's in that more technical vein, there are certain standards and things that have to be met. Something that's more meditational and not requiring certain technical levels, you know, it's just a slightly different pathway. And so the right person who could walk you through it would be following up with you.
Okay. And so some people submit full books, I guess, and others,
it does happen.
Others just maybe submit an idea or maybe a chapter or two.
Right, that definitely happens.
And then the process continues at that point. Right. What is self-publishing done? Because a lot of people can say, oh, I can get published with this press or that press, and it's pretty much pay and you get it done and you get a few books.
Right.
How is that affected?
I mean, Amazon even does a self-publishing trajectory. And I'm not one who's going to say there's never any good that comes out of self-publishing. There's been more than one novel, for example, that started off that way and had a success, and then publisher that decides, hey, we should help this and jump in and offer someone a lot of money and then try to grow it and so on. Mm. So it's not that that's never a good idea. What you do lose certain things, at least in academic publishing, if you are just doing the self-publishing route. Now, if you're doing something that's not for the academy, you're sort of just trying your luck and you're on your own, you know. So
in terms of distribution and
distribution, marketing,
and
you know, getting the word out to podcasters like this and to talk and to journals and to all of that, you're really on your own. So I'm not saying it can't ever be done. I've known people who've done it. But you're flying solo. What you lose in academic publishing, if that's what you wind up doing, is the center of expertise that good publishers have built, the weight of that. And there is a quality expertise that the main publishers have built for themselves. And not just us. We certainly have worked hard to do that, but I know that's true of a number of my colleagues' presses. You lose the connectivity to global publishing for translations. You lose the expertise around marketing that exists. So it's not that it's without any value, and maybe for some people that's a way to start, to put some ideas out there.
So some people have gotten noticed by doing self-publishing.
Right. I would say for everyone who has, there's probably 1,000 who have not gotten beyond a few dozen copies finding their way into people's hands.
Yeah.
And you know, any book, even with publishers, can be given attention and not amount to a lot. There's a lot of publishing. There's more publishing than there are potential readers for some projects. But you do have the backing of a professional team that's on your side. And that's why I think if you can get published by a solid press, be it Cascade or some of the other fine publishing houses, it's worth trying.
Last question: three books that you're looking forward to coming out this year that you've had something to do with.
Wow, that's
is that a tough one?
It's tough in terms of me thinking through the timing.
Okay,
of these things.
I mean, next year, but something, maybe something's just come out or something.
Sure,
yeah, three things you're excited about.
Well, three things I'm excited about. In terms of books that have come out recently. Think for a second. It's funny. My brain is just turning blank.
Yeah. Well, that may be an unfair question.
No, it's a perfectly fair question. If this is where you're going to have to edit
the text
a little bit. Let me give it half a thought. I'm very excited by some of the larger projects that we're undertaking, and I'm often talking about those. But a number of those are not yet producing books. And so we have a series in Christology that you're involved with.
Right.
That's very, very exciting.
The studies in early Christology.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And we have a Pauline studies series now that we have the editors in place, and we're actually starting to recruit for that. I'm very excited by that. This past year, I was very, very excited to be involved with the Nick Walterstorff and Kurt Van Beek project, which was a correspondence dealing with justice. Nicholas Walterstorff is the philosopher, and Kurt Van Beek is a professor of ethics and also an activist in Honduras, connected to Calvin College. So it took the sort of the theory and the practice of justice and brought them together in a very good exchange that was widely read ahead of time, so people could say if it was helpful and so on. It was called Called for Justice. That was a book I was very excited to be a part of. There's just a good number more. I mean, I don't know where to begin.
Yeah, but you started at Whippenstock, so we'll wait and see what happens in the next 5 years.
Sure. Maybe one other I could mention briefly is, now that my brain is kicking back into gear, there's a very fine book by Graham Twelvetree that we did on Paul. It didn't make the series because it came out before the series was conceived. Paul's Gospel, I think, is the core of the title, but Graham Twelvetree, that came out just before SBL. And the last one I should mention that is partly close to my heart is the book by Gene Green on Vox Petri. It's a dozen years of work in that book.
Yeah, I was excited to see that coming out. I'm glad you mentioned that book.
I want to get
Gene down here.
Gene would love to talk about this book.
He's now moved to Florida to work in the extension of Trinity International University.
That's right. And I think he'll be great for that as well. But the he's never worked longer on a book than Vox Petri.
He's got a lot of great insights in that book as well.
Yeah, no, it was greatly received. You'll see on the endorsements in the book were rich and varied. So I have high hopes. It's a big book. I told him we needed to do a
small
petri dish.
Petri dish version of Vox Petri, the voice of Peter.
Indeed.
Voice of Peter.
Right.
Michael, thanks for being with us. We hope you come back to the
Lunar. I'd love to come back, and I'm sorry for my little stumbling at the end, but
No worries. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thanks to Brent Johnson and Janet Seifert for editing these podcasts. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.